Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Iraqi fighters are posing as civilians to deceive and then attack American-led troops. Iraqi militia are using civilians as shields. Recent days have seen a first suicide attack on U.S. troops and the promise of more. The U.S. military has technology and weaponry far superior to that of Iraqi forces. But Iraqi guerrilla tactics are rapidly complicating this war morally, strategically, and tactically. Tonight on Point, a cold shower of unconventional warfare in Iraq and how America should respond. We begin with a top-level assessment of latest developments on the war front. Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Armies. I asked him how he sees the military plans and problems unfolding in Iraq.
We've got three operations, really, or three parts of the operation ongoing. We've got the air attacks on the Republican Guard south of Baghdad, and they're heavy, relentless, and they're pounding away. I mean, what we must hope is that they're actually hitting these mobile targets on the ground, tanks, armored personnel carriers, artillery, targets like that. We've got another operation ongoing around Basra, where the British forces are securing the area steadily, and they're nibbling away at the outskirts of Basra town. And as I've said before, it's really important to watch the way that that goes, because I think coalition policy for the big city is being made on the hoof there. And the way that they treat Basra at the end of the day will almost certainly be the way that they treat Baghdad. And then we've got these ongoing battles around Karbala, Najaf, Samawa, and, of course, Nasiriyah, which everyone's heard so much about. Mm-hmm. And the situation in all of those areas is still confused. I mean, there is no doubt whatsoever that there is still heavy Iraqi resistance in all of those areas. And what we're looking for at some stage in the next few days, probably Karbala, Najaf area, is for the coalition to get across the Euphrates. Because what they've been doing for quite a long time now is closing up to the Euphrates. They need to get across, and at some stage they need to resume that march on Baghdad. Now, whether they do that before they get reinforcements from the 4th Division and from the 1st Cavalry, that's open to debate, and we just have to watch and see how events go.
I guess this phrase asymmetric warfare has come into the conversation around this war, and even the phrase guerrilla war. Do you have any doubt that sooner or later, U.S. and U.K. conventional forces can be marshaled in such a way as to produce a victory, or could we be pulled into something asymmetrical, something guerrilla that denies that?
Well, that's my worry. There are no clear-cut answers to this. There is certainly a burst of enthusiasm from the Iraqis for this asymmetric, guerrilla, partisan, behind-the-lines warfare. We need to see if this is something that's going to be prolonged and sustained, or it's something that's going to die away after another 2 or 3 days. And I think the next week is going to be absolutely crucial here, because if this sort of thing is going on this time next week and we haven't been able to control it in the rear areas, then we're going to have to think very, very carefully about how we play this. And we may be coming up with an answer, something along the lines of the reinforcements that are on the way are going to be nowhere near enough, and we're going to need massive reinforcement, both from the U.S. and from the U.K.
A massive reinforcement to address what exactly?
Well, to control the countryside, to allow the major columns to move on to their objectives, and then for pacification after that. If we look at this carefully, okay, we take Baghdad and we cut off the head of the regime, but then we may have a lot of other towns in Iraq, quite large towns that also have to be taken bit by bit. And you can, when you look at the large-scale map, you really can. You can see quite a large number of towns around here that that are going to take quite a lot in the way of military operations to subdue them. So if we were to sort of establish a timeline and say, okay, in a month to 6 weeks, we have Baghdad, but then we probably have another 6 weeks, maybe even 2 months, to take some of these other towns. Resistance might be very, very fierce in some of these other towns. Just by cutting off the head of the regime, Saddam Hussein, and his closest henchmen, there is a strong possibility that this will not end the campaign on the nail at that moment.
If it doesn't, is even doubling the number of troops there now in a country of 24 million enough to pacify a restive population?
It's too early to tell. If it's something that's just a burst and it's over in 10 days or so, mm-hmm. or the worst of it's over in 10 days, mm-hmm. then the task is simpler. If it's not over in 10 days, and this is something that's going to be ongoing and it's going to be a feature of this campaign all the way through, for every single target that we try and attack in a conventional manner, then we have a real problem on our hands that's going to take an awful lot of fixing.
What about the troops? U.S. troops, U.K. troops, they're suddenly now confronting suicide bombers, warriors in civilian clothes, fake surrenders. Are they trained for this? What kind of impact do you expect it will have on their effectiveness and morale?
Well, first of all, I know full well that the British troops are trained for this. I'm pretty sure the American troops may not have been trained specifically for it, but they're flexible enough to cope with it. Mm. I mean, this is a military problem that you have to deal with, and these guys are flexible. They'll soon, very, very quickly, develop tactics to deal with suicide bombers and this sort of thing. The worry, actually, is that these troops who are on the ground now, and basically we've got this 3-4 divisional grouping, if it takes too long to get the reinforcements in from the 4th Division, 1st Cavalry and the 1st Armoured, that by the time they actually get in and join the battle, the troops who are on the ground now are going to be absolutely worn out. So instead of having, say, 6 divisional groups in the battle, you, in fact, just replace 3 divisional groups with another 3 divisional groups, and we're almost back to square one.
Your overall strength is no greater.
The overall effectiveness mm-hmm. of the force is no greater. And that's not to criticize the British and the American soldiers mm-hmm. on the ground. I mean, they have had a very, very hard time over the last few days. And the stress on them as they were waiting to go across the start line from Kuwait was tremendous. And I was talking to people about this, and I wouldn't say they were worn out by any means, but it was hard sitting in the desert waiting to go and not knowing what you were going to face. It was almost a relief for them once they got across the border. But, you know, in 3 weeks, a month's time, I wouldn't say they'll be used up, but their effectiveness must diminish. So we could be almost back to square one there. So I think the planners in London and Washington are almost certainly now saying, we've got to look at our force levels and we've got to think about some massive reinforcement.
Even beyond what was already planned, what's already underway?
Yeah. I think almost certainly. Military operations are about just in case, not just in time. You've got to be ready for every single eventuality. And the Colin Powell doctrine of overwhelming force is almost certainly the right doctrine to use in this case as we have it at the moment. Overwhelming force gives the generals and the commanders on the ground some options. Instead of being pressed against the wall by hordes of jihadis and guerrilla partisan fighters in the rear, if they've got large numbers of troops that they can deploy, it means they have a much, much better chance of controlling the situation.
Major Charles Heyman served 30 years in the British military. He is now editor of Jane's World Armies. He spoke with me earlier from Shrewsbury, England. Today, U.S. troops killed 10 Iraqis, most of them women and children, when their van did not stop at a checkpoint at a highway near Najaf, south of Baghdad. This was not the war plan. On Saturday, 4 U.S. Army soldiers were killed when an Iraqi soldier dressed as a civilian blew himself up in a taxi cab at a U.S. checkpoint. All over southern and central Iraq, militiamen disguised as civilians are firing at American-led forces and taking cover behind civilian populations. They're faking surrender, fighting from the rooftops of homes. there will no doubt still be large conventional battles in Iraq. And the U.S. military is well prepared for those. But the hard day-to-day reality for U.S. troops and commanders right now is unconventional warfare, almost counter-insurgency in murky confrontations. Heart-wrenching pictures from Iraq are poignantly showing the moral challenges and tough tactical choices soldiers are now being forced to take on. Is this the war you expected? How do we conclude a successful war against suicide bombers and militia in civilian clothing? How do U.S. forces extract the bad guys of Saddam's regime without killing and alienating civilians? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Stephen Van Evra, director of the Security Studies Program at MIT, professor of political science and author of Causes of War, Power and the Roots of Conflict. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Van Evra.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for being with us. And with me from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Steve.
Steve Van Evra, here we are. We spent a lot of the last week adjusting to expectations that were not borne out, but it continues. The picture continues to evolve. We all saw the pictures over the weekend of the one singular photograph of the U.S. Marine. I believe he was a Marine doctor holding a tiny Iraqi girl. Her family's car had been caught in the crossfire. Her mother killed. We just went through the kind of list of terribly awkward situations and horrible challenges that U.S. soldiers are now facing in what looks increasingly unconventional. How much is the outcome of this war likely to ride on unconventional conflict versus big confrontation that still lies ahead, we're told, with Republican Guard in and around Baghdad?
Well, heavily, because we've got to get control of these southern cities if we're ever going to get to Baghdad. And that means we've got to control the We've got to deal with this problem of unconventional attack in the southern cities. Then, in the end, we're going to have to get control of Baghdad also. And unless the regime implodes and we get a quick surrender, and we can all hope for that, but I don't think it's likely, we're going to have to do the same work in Baghdad. So we've got to deal with this problem.
We heard Charles Heyman at the top of the hour saying that in his book, this calls for massive reinforcements, for many more troops than the 100,000-plus additional troops that are already en route to the scattered war front in Iraq. Can you imagine the Pentagon, Steve Van Evra, bellying up to that, putting out a call for another 50, another 75, another 100,000 troops to supplement the 275,000 or so, which are already, or 300,000, which are already in the Gulf?
Well, I don't know if they'll do it because it will amount to admitting they were wrong, but I think they should do it. I think Rumsfeld made a basic error in designing the war plan by undermanning it, putting too few troops in the Gulf and putting too little heavy forces in the Gulf. And that risked downside surprises, making a mess of the plan. And I think he was listening too much to his Air Force friends who have long preached that you can basically win wars from the air and, you know, ground forces aren't very important. And he put a cap on the total size of the ground forces. And that was a mistake. And they've got to admit that mistake now. And I agree with
Charles Heyman.
Charles Heyman, yeah. We've got to reinforce heavily. The one way to reduce both the political pain and the length of any guerrilla fighting in these southern cities and in Baghdad is to overwhelm the areas with troops. People won't resist if they see that we're arriving with overwhelming force and we can reduce the length of the fighting and the number of losses and the ugly spectacle, all of it, with big forces.
Jack Beatty, it is heart-wrenching this weekend. We want this war to be over fast, and we want U.S. troops to be able to get it over with, and we can only imagine the kind of circumstances that leave a U.S. Marine holding a tiny girl, that left U.S. soldiers today firing on a van that scared the daylights out of them and ending up killing, first reported 7, now 10 Iraqi civilians, mostly women and children. This isn't where we want to see our soldiers.
No, it isn't, and it puts them in a tragic position. I mean, the imperatives of survival are shoot. But on the other hand, the political imperative of this war is to emerge with it without having wrecked our political position irretrievably in the world and especially in the Middle East. And when so you're asking the soldiers essentially to put themselves at risk in order to advance our political aims. That's a lot to ask of soldiers. You know, the Israelis point to Jenin. They went in there in last year light. They didn't level the place, at least at first, and they lost 25 men, I think, in a week. And one of the reasons they did was that they tried to avoid civilian casualties. And, of course, they wanted to avoid charges of a bloodbath. Well, in any case, they were charged with a bloodbath, even though only 52 people were killed at Jenin.
We've got to take a short break, Jack. Stand by. We're looking at unconventional warfare in Iraq, suicide bombers, human shields, coercive tyranny, and the counterinsurgency challenge. Is this the war you expected? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. On Point, we're talking tonight about unconventional warfare breaking out in Iraq, all over the place, suicide bombers, human shields, coercive tyranny, and the counterinsurgency challenge now facing U.S. troops. What was your reaction to the suicide bomb attack in Iraq, to the announcement that this is Baghdad policy now? And how do U.S. forces extract the bad guys without harming civilians? How can we keep clarity on this battlefield? Can we? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The PSYOPs war to win over hearts and minds among the Iraqi people may now be more crucial than ever. Here's a broadcast captured today from Radio Tikrit, a U.S.-sponsored radio station that broadcasts anti-Saddam Hussein messages from Kuwait.
Dear listeners, many Iraqis are wondering why they should pay for Saddam Hussein's mistakes. Why should the brave men of the Iraqi army fight and sacrifice their dear lives so Saddam can live? He does not respect their capabilities and heroic deeds and has led them from battle to battle, destroying Iraq and its potential. Saddam Hussein wants the army and the people to sacrifice their lives so he and his children can live. He refuses to play any role, however small it might be, in order not to endanger his life.
An American anti-Saddam Hussein message broadcast over the Black Ops U.S.-controlled station Radio Tikrit. Tikrit is the birthplace of Saddam Hussein, and a translation provided there by the BBC. Stephen Van Evra, there's so much I want to hear about tonight in how we make the turn into this kind of confrontation. I guess this recording speaks to one element, which is the effort that is underway from Radio Tikrit, U.S.-sponsored, to sway Iraqi civilians so that this is not an ocean that Saddam's henchmen and thugs and militia can easily swim in. Can that work?
Well, yes, it can if we do it with a lot more energy than we're doing it now. I'm glad that we're doing something here, as you heard from that tape. But I don't think we prepared this war well by having our PSYOPs in place. There was some taking for granted of Iraqi opinion in our favor before the war.
But we've heard about 35 million leaflets dropped over the country. That's 1.5 for every man, woman, and child, nearly. That's not enough?
Well, no, it's not. And, even the nature of the message we just heard, it was a series of general statements. We need to teach the Iraqi history, the actual history of Saddam's regime. We assume that they know his crimes. Actually, they don't know his crimes. Each person in each neighborhood knows bad things done to people in their, five-block area. But the overall path of ruin and murder that he's left in Iraq isn't known to the Iraqi people. If you ask people in the street in Baghdad, how many people has Saddam murdered, if they were to give you an honest answer, even if they gave you one, they wouldn't know, and I think they greatly underestimated. He's actually murdered between 400,000 and 500,000 Iraqis. That should be a number we should repeat again and again and again. We should take people through when he murdered people, who he murdered, which massacres, how the secret police have done things.
We need a big teach-in here on the regime of Saddam Hussein and its record.
Exactly, a real factual teaching. We should stop assuming that these facts are known and obvious to people, because they're not. And the facts are truly horrible and very compelling. The second thing is we should be talking about our intentions. We have to realize our intentions are very widely suspected, not just throughout the wide Arab world, but in Iraq.
And, of course, the Iraqi regime has, until very recently, been on TV all the time, painting those intentions through their own viewfinder.
Exactly. And we shouldn't assume that just because these charges sound absurd to us, they're not believed. One of the sort of iron laws of debate is, charges not answered are believed. We need to address this argument that we're there for oil. We need to explain, well, why are we there? And are we there for oil or not? What are we going to do with Iraq? So every Iraqi needs to hear the American side of the story. And I think we need to hear it. By the way, I don't think just U.S. officials should be talking about it. We should exploit the fact that there are a lot of folk who could help explain our intentions to the Iraqis.
Jack Beatty, this should not be entirely surprising. I mean, Saddam Hussein is well known for using any weapon at hand, and his regime's survival is at stake here. So this can't come as completely out of the blue.
You would think not, even independent reporting on Iraq, such as one has seen a little bit in recent years, has struck me with one thing, and that is over here we understand that the sanctions were essentially a barbaric deprivation on the part of Saddam of his own people, that he was building palaces, making weapons, and so on.
You mean what little cash did get through he didn't share with the populace?
That's right. That's our understanding of it, but that's not the way the Iraqi man and woman on the street sees it, as I was recently reminded by a listener to our program. The sanctions, Saddam has quite successfully blamed on us, and these have been a kind of weapon of mass destruction, killing. I mean,
taking apart the Iraqi economy, sort of one business and family at a time.
That's right, and of course the frightful numbers on infant mortality and children who don't survive beyond five, and so on. So all of that, I think, is another thing that we're having to combat. Not only are these people afraid of Saddam, not only do the Shia remember 1991 when we betrayed them, but I think everybody has this idea that somehow the sanctions were our cruelty on them.
But at this point, we've got a job to do, and we've got to find a good way to do it. Steve Van Evra, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Minneapolis, Joel Turnipseed. He served as Lance Corporal in the 6th Motor Transport Battalion in the Gulf War. He's author of the soon-to-be-released book, Baghdad Express, a Gulf War Memoir. Good evening and welcome, Joel Turnipseed.
Thanks for having me on.
Joel, you're on with us the very first night of the war. You've watched this unfold, as we all have, with kind of bated breath. And you've seen the twists and turns it has already taken. Give us a sense from your experience in the military what this must look like at this point from the troopers' point of view. You've heard this news of the van that was fired on tonight with 10, mainly women and children, killed. That's not anything that a trooper wants to come home with.
No, and that van was not the first. I just read a report yesterday of some Marines who had to kill a woman and her 10-year-old son who were playing forward observer. I think what we all need to remember is these kids are not automatons.
By these kids, you mean U.S. soldiers?
Yeah, U.S. soldiers. They're going to kill a woman and her kid. The truck driver is going to pee himself when his tire blows because he thinks he's just been shelled. Everyone is on edge. They're very tired. And every possible emotion is in play right now.
What from your perspective, I mean, you weren't the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. You were driving a truck in the Gulf War in the Marines. But what should Washington do to help the troops who are in the field dealing with this situation?
Well, one thing that I have been saying to my friends who ask me questions is I take a lot more comfort in the professionalism of the American troops than in the administration. And these guys are arm and con, as a tractor trailer driver, I can tell you I felt like the broadside of the barn. I also got lost twice.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't a surprise to me when those 12 Army truckers got lost.
One of the very first kind of wake-up calls that there were going to be some problems here.
Well, that's just the nature of war. And so I think, the best thing that these commanders can do, and it's also on the NCOs, the corporals, the sergeants, is when the young kid unfurls his American flag and wants to stick it on top of a building he's just captured,
mm-hmm.
it's up to his sergeant to say, listen, kid, put that thing back in your Alice pack. That's not needed.
We're not here for conquest or symbols of conquest.
Right. And so I really think this is going to be a battle for the hearts and minds of those NCOs, of those captains, of those second lieutenants, the ones who are spending every day with the troops to keep their heads straight and to keep the oorah inside the Hummer, ultimately.
There's the voice of a Marine veteran of Gulf War I, Joel Turnipseed. Stick with us. Steve Van Evra, I want to look just at the facts of reinforcement. We hear Charles Hayman at the top of the hour, and you also saying we need a lot more troops in there just as fast as we can. A, do we have the troops? Are they available in the U.S. military right now? And B, when you deploy a much greater number, what do you do with them to counteract this kind of unconventional war?
We've got the troops. The question is, how comfortable are we putting them all in the Mideast? We've got another whole problem over there in Northeast Asia with North Korea. And the more we concentrate in Iraq, the more we leave other places open for trouble. And when the cat's away, the mice can play.
But we really have another, I don't know what, let's say 100,000 troops at the ready that would be appropriate for this conflict?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, we have a total of 10 Army divisions and 3 Marine divisions. And right now we have, of that total, 3 to 4 now in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm. So, and 3 more on the way.
Sure. Yeah, we can.
So that leaves another 4. But as you say, the idea is not to have everyone deployed in one region.
Correct. We've got to hold something back because those mice will play if the cat's completely away.
And if we get in there with that kind of reinforcement and just with the extra 100,000 that are already on their way, what do we do tactically that changes the texture of what we've seen in the first week and a half?
Well, you know, one thing I hope we don't do is change tactics too much. I've heard people calling for taking a tougher policy. Take off the gloves. Let's respond to these terror attacks, suicide bombings, et cetera, by trading off our lives for civilian lives. And I think that'd be a terrible mistake. We have got to suck it up and find tactical ways of coping with these new surprises we're facing. There are better ways to run a checkpoint than we were running it that day that we got attacked by the suicide bomber.
Mm-hmm.
There are better ways to run a checkpoint than happened today when the van got shot up.
Easy to say, hard to do in the field when you've had civilian. We've had reports from the field of soldiers who are facing civilian vehicles coming at them all day long in waves. And now here comes a van, and instead of a machine gun, it has at least 10 women and children in it.
Well, some things you do are simply physical. You're going to have to create some barriers so that the traffic is channeled and you tightly control your interaction with each vehicle. Mm-hmm. So the interaction occurs under your terms, and that's going to require some physical structuring of the checkpoints and rebuilding them and making sure that at any given time you have no more than one soldier who is exposed should the vehicle explode. And furthermore, that you only another thing is simply have barriers at all the checkpoints so that if a vehicle doesn't stop in your command, it stops by a barrier. It bangs into a barrier. You don't have to shoot it to make it stop.
A lot of work to do, and not all these people are on roads. Some, of course, we've all seen how you can drive right across open desert in Iraq, and I don't know what the circumstances were with the van today. Steve Van Evra, Joel Turnipseed, Jack Standby. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. We're talking tonight about unconventional warfare in Iraq. Damien's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Damien. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is obviously a topic of primary going on right now, and
it's on everybody's mind.
Absolutely, and my friends respond with incredulousness at these reports of the guerrilla tactics, and I have to remind them that that's how the colonists defeated the British Army back in the Revolutionary War. It was using comparatively unconventional war tactics.
I mean, not playing by the British rules.
Right, and it sort of begs the question. So, what's to stop the coalition soldiers from? Now that you hear Iraqi leadership saying any coalition soldiers who offer to surrender will be treated with mercy. What's to stop our soldiers from waving a white flag and then when they get close, start shooting them?
Well, let's hope that they don't even need to do that often. We haven't seen much of that yet. But so you're saying, Damien, we should just get right down there with them and.
Not necessarily, because
Would you encourage our soldiers to use human shields of Iraqi civilians?
No, not necessarily. And I agree with what your last guest just said about we can't send our own suicide bombers in. But just a matter of we just points to the problem of being unprepared for this conflict because we weren't thinking in the mindset of the Middle Easterners. We were thinking in the mindset of the Westerners and that's sort of I guess all that I'm thinking.
Got it. Thanks, Damien, for your call. Joel Turnipseed. Can you see a way for the U.S. to play tougher here? And as a Marine vet of Gulf War I, would you recommend it?
No. I don't think the Marines have even forgotten Lebanon yet, so they certainly know the power of a truck filled with explosives.
Mm-hmm.
But the plain fact of the matter is, like I said, it's the professionalism of the NCO Corps, of those Lance Corporals, of those young lieutenants in the field at those checkpoints, that's going to win this war. If this devolves into a dirty people's war, big countries with fancy planes don't win people's wars. And so ultimately, we need to hope that these young kids keep their heads on straight in tremendous stress. And I think that, you know, that's our greatest hope of winning this war.
If I could just jump in.
Stephen Evra.
To me, the key to winning a counterinsurgency war like this is intelligence. If you can separate the good guys from the bad guys, you can win. And if you can know who in Basra is with the bad guys and who in Basra is with the good guys, your problems are over.
How do you do that? The British can hardly even get into Basra yet after a week.
Correct. Well, basically, you need to do it because you need to get everybody in the town to tell you. You need to have your friends in town who are your eyes and ears who tell you.
How do you get that started, that cascade of information that leads to sorting out what now looks like chaos?
Two elements. First is you've got to legitimate the policy in the eyes of the population where the guerrillas are hiding. We've got to convince the town folk that our policy is legitimate, and at a minimum to kind of understand that we're not doing bad things, and at a maximum to understand that we're the good guys. That goes back to the psyops business. It goes back to otherwise conducting ourselves in an honorable and generous way. It goes back to other stuff we haven't done well so far. For example, we should look really sorry when we kill civilians.
Are you saying we don't?
We haven't been good at looking sorry.
How do you know that? I mean, on the ground, are you sure on the ground that there's callousness demonstrated?
Well, the statements that come out of Washington and out of the military command are they have a perfunctory flavor to them.
Even at the top level.
Yes, yes. I think we should behave more the way Japanese corporate leaders do when they hurt somebody. You
deep
go
sorrows.
To the home of the individual you've hurt and you apologize face to face. I think our commander should say every single civilian who dies by American arms is an error. This is a mistake, a terrible mistake. We don't claim we never make mistakes. We are going to make mistakes in this war, but we acknowledge every single civilian we kill is an error we've made that's a tragedy, and we will carry it in our hearts forever.
That doesn't seem like a hard thing to do, given that we want to win the friendship of this population, not alienate them.
Well, I mean, I think we don't use the right words because people don't like to admit error. They think it's not the right thing to do in a war, but it is the right thing to do in this context. Where, as I said, the whole name of the game is to legitimate what we're doing in the eyes of the population. Then the second thing, I said the two main ways of winning over enough people in town to be your eyes and ears so that they'll tell you where the bad guys are. One is legitimate yourself. The second is you've got to look strong enough to make people think you're there to stay. Mm. And that gets back to this matter of reinforcing our forces. We have to convince everyone in the area that we have the muscle in the end to win this game, and if they do give us help, we're not going to leave them high and dry. They're going to be on the winning side. So those are the two things we've got to do.
Mm-hmm. Be there in strength, and when you do something that's not good, say so. Jack Beatty, this whole idea of unconventional warfare and counterinsurgency, which it practically feels like now, has got a feeling about it that as Americans we don't like.
No, and we had an experience with it in the Philippines and then in Vietnam. And Vietnam seems to be one of the models that's been thrown out here. The focus seemed to be Gulf War I, but with half the troops. And the Vietnam experience, counterinsurgency, trying to separate the guerrillas, the cadre from the people, not killing civilians, but at the same time protecting yourself, all of these questions seem to have been put into the memory bank or the memory hole in the Army. It's as if Vietnam is for our professional military a kind of no man's land. We don't want to think about that.
Well, let's see. We'll hope not. We'll hope that there's institutional memory and a way to learn and do better. We're talking tonight about unconventional warfare in Iraq, suicide bombers, human shields, coercive tyranny, and the counterinsurgency challenge. Did you see the picture of the Marine cradling that little girl whose parents, mother, had been killed? Can you feel the moral quandary of our soldiers? How do we maintain our moral balance in a sea of tyranny and ambiguity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about unconventional warfare in Iraq. We've seen it blossoming all over South and Central Iraq to the great discomfort and danger of U.S. troops there and the discomfort and danger to Iraqi civilians. The report in just tonight, a first reported 7 and now 10 Iraqi women and children killed when a van approached U.S. soldiers who clearly feared that it was an attack. And many attacks have come from civilian vehicles. What do we do here? Can we avoid the slippery slope from war to counterinsurgency? Are you ready for unconventional, asymmetrical warfare? Do we risk destroying the village in order to save it. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Steve Van Evra, director of the Security Studies Program at MIT, and Joel Turnipseed, calling us, joining us from Minneapolis, Minnesota tonight, a veteran, Marine veteran of the first Gulf War and author of the soon-to-be-released book Baghdad Express, a Gulf War memoir. You can join us as well. Jeff's calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much. It's a great show, and a lot of the opinions your guests have come forth with are really excellent. I think that we have to show tremendous restraint, tremendous maturity as we discuss these conflicts and not sensationalize them. I think it's very powerful to show pictures of the civilians who get caught in the crossfire, but that's not what we're there for. Now that happens.
Can I just interrupt for a second there, Jeff? We'll get to your question, but I want to get to this issue of sensationalism. When that soldier is shown on page one of newspapers around the country holding the Iraqi girl with the story about what happened to her family, is that sensationalism or is that alerting Americans to what's going on here? Well, how do you see it?
If Americans are so naive to think you go into a war and civilians don't get killed, then they've got to go back to their history class. This is a war. And take any war in history, this is probably one of the least brutal wars that's ever taken place.
So civilian deaths very low at this point.
Yeah, I mean, this is amazing. So I think that people have to realize that civilians will get killed, and I think, as your guest said, we need to apologize. We need to make the psychops value of those deaths as low as possible for Saddam. And, oh, by the way, we've done an abhorrent job as a government in understanding the psychology of the environment, of the Arabic people, of the entire scheme that Saddam has painted. I mean, this man is a master at manipulating feelings and manipulating people, at throwing resources at a problem. Mm. He's just excellent.
You think he's outgamed us on that front, Jeff?
Oh, he's light years ahead of us. I mean, he's up there with Joseph Goebbels. He's a master. But we need to take a page from this guy and say, look, this is not a war militarily that's going to be won or lost, because, of course, we're going to win the war that way. Mm. This is the war that's for the hearts and minds of the world, and we're in very grave danger of losing that. And unfortunately, you hate to say that the media should not report things. I'm not saying that they should self-censor, but let's keep things in perspective and show all the people that Saddam has murdered in various ways, the guns that are to the back of the civilians who are driving the truck towards our checkpoint.
And they often are. We've got it, Jeff. Thank you very much for your call. Let's take this right from the ground level up. Joel Turnipseed, you were there on the ground. You've been there as a U.S. Marine in the Gulf. Do you think that we'd be better off not showing what's going on? Would that help? Would that help us win a public relations war here?
No, and actually, I think there's a terrible thing that goes on in war that I haven't heard talked about yet, and that is, you know, many of the most, you know, teary conversations I've had with vets are that 2 a.m. where the guy who was in Panama and killed 100 people when he was supposed to be taking out a soldier installation can't admit it because the government hasn't admitted yet, or the guy on the drug raid in Mexico who loses 3 of his guys when that raid didn't take place.
So from a soldier's perspective, being upfront about it, you're saying freeze them to deal with what they're doing.
Yeah, it's not psychologically healthy to just deny what really happens in war, which is messy. And so I don't know that you have to do it right now, the day after their mom and dad learned that they did it.
Mm-hmm.
But just per se, I think we have to be very careful about the psychological health of our guys fighting there, not just Saddam's guys and those civilians and the world opinion.
Yeah. Stephen Ever, what about this issue of naivete? Is the American public demonstrating naivete when it responds with emotion to these images? Or is this just that nuanced a situation where we know we can't afford to have this kind of thing going on if we want to win with the Iraqi people?
Well, I think we've got to put things in context. I agree with the caller, Jeff, in Andover, and also with Joel. Hey, the facts are the facts. You got to admit them, and you got to let the world see them. The point is to put them in the context of the larger facts. For example, how often do you hear that Saddam's regime, throughout its existence, from the time the man came to power, has murdered, on average, 50 people a day? Okay,
that's over many, many years.
Yeah, over since he came to power in 79. He's murdered 50 people a day, and then his international adventures, his wars and so on, have gotten him another If you add them in, you got over 100 people a day killed. Then if you add in the number of people who were killed by the sanctions, and I agree with Jack Beatty, Saddam deserves complete blame for them, and that's another 200,000 to 250,000 people. You're up to 200 people a day that have been killed by this regime. So when we see, oh, my God, something horrible happened today at a checkpoint and 10 or 15 people got killed, we should remind ourselves this is a drop in the bucket compared to the blood toll this regime has routinely taken daily throughout its life.
Stephen Everett, you've given us a number of elements of how we can turn this around. Do you fear that it won't be turned around, that it will devolve into a kind of nationwide counterinsurgency campaign? I think most Americans would much prefer a military-on-military conflict here that doesn't go that way. Is this so far kind of marginal, containable, and soon we'll be facing Republican guards, not militiamen in civilian clothes?
I think it's containable if we're smart, if we reinforce quickly, if we keep our eye on the ball, meaning keep our eye on the need to legitimate this fighting in the eyes of the population of Iraq. Don't go overboard. Let's not loosen the rules of engagement. Let's not start encouraging our folk to try to eliminate all risk to themselves by playing real hardball at the checkpoints. Let's keep our eye on the ball here. Play this smart. We should be taking lessons from our British allies, by the way, who've had long experience with urban warfare in Northern Ireland. And our troops should basically be handling the checkpoint problems and the interface with the public problems the way the Brits do. And if we're smart, you know, like I said, there's a good example right in front of us.
It can still be knitted up. Stephen Everett, it's great of you to join us tonight. We're always pleased to have you on. Thanks so much for being here.
Fun to be here.
Stephen Van Everett is director of the Security Studies Program and a professor of political science at MIT, author of Causes of War, Power, and the Roots of Conflict. And Joel Turnipseed, we love that ground-level insight you give us and the compassion we feel in you for the soldiers and everybody out there. Thank you for joining us from Minneapolis tonight.
Thank you.
Joel Turnipseed was a Marine veteran in Gulf War I. He's author of the forthcoming book, Baghdad Express, a Gulf War memoir. Jack Beatty, we do not want to get down nationally into counterinsurgency. We've been there in another country or two, and it's not a fun place to be.
No, and politically, it's just poison to us. Jeff's point about the political surround today, President Mubarak of Egypt said that this war, I quote him, is creating 100 Osama bin Ladens.
And that from the president of Egypt, an ally who has no interest in that happening himself.
That's right. That's a mortal threat to him, too.
Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a view from inside the Iraqi port city of Umm Qasr. This is On Point. Under the Ba'athist regime of Saddam Hussein, the predominantly Shiite population in southern Iraq has faced high unemployment, malnutrition, chronic water shortages, and brutal rule from Baghdad. In the last week, residents of the southern port city of Umm Qasr, now controlled by British soldiers, saw a glimmer of what life may be like after Saddam. But not all Iraqis there see a Western military presence as a welcome replacement for that hard life, at least not yet. Thanasi Kambanis is a correspondent with the Boston Globe in Umm Qasr. I asked him to describe the reception that coalition forces have been getting in southern Iraq.
It's decidedly mixed. This is as friendly as they expect people to be anywhere in Iraq because the Shia were oppressed, especially after the uprising in 1991. But still, the people here are anywhere from neutral to hostile towards the coalition forces. The hope of the coalition is that as aid flows in and the quality of life improves, that people are going to be happier to have them here. But from what conversations I've been able to have with the locals, ambivalence is almost too kind of word. They don't want the Americans and the British here. They don't like Saddam Hussein. They did not like their lives before. You know, they aspire to a better life, but they don't want it under what they see as an occupying army.
Thanasi, you're in Umm Qasr, where coalition forces have been as long as anywhere in the country since the invasion began. What kind of steps are British troops, who I guess dominate there, what kind of steps are they taking to try and win over the local people?
Well, this town is viewed as the test lab for the coalition's efforts to rebuild this country. Here, it's a British-led effort. Today was a big day for them. They got the electricity turned back on to about three-quarters of Umm Qasr. They've been working at that since they've been here. They restored one generator. Now their light's on at night. They also, yesterday, got drinkable water running in a pipeline up to the Iraqi border so that it can be distributed in trucks to the local people here. The biggest problem was a huge shortage of drinking water. Drinking water was one of the methods of control used by the Ba'ath Party to keep people on a tight tether. So there's no drinking water from faucets. It would come from trucks supplied by the government. For about 11 days after the war started, that distribution chain was cut off, and you would see flocks of people on the edge of the road begging for water, making the motion of pouring a water bottle into their mouths or coming up to the window and knocking and saying, "Water." So they were very pleased as of yesterday to have 1.5 million liters flowing across the border that they can give out for free to the residents of Umm Qasr.
So at this point, citizens there have electricity, they have water, they're presumably getting decent treatment from the British troops. Why this mixed reception? Pick it apart for us. What are the elements of it?
I think the obvious one is that people don't like foreign troops in their country. And no matter how we cut this as a liberation, they view it as an invasion and an occupation. Obviously, a lot of suspicion mixed in about whether we're here for the oil resources, whether our interests really are to help them. And the most common doubt voiced is about whether the coalition troops will stay. The memories of 1991 loom very large here. In almost every conversation I've had, they've said, "We don't want to speak out. We won't give our last names. We're still convinced that soon these coalition troops will be gone and we're going to have to face Saddam's regime again."
So it's kind of a mixed signal there, with on the one hand saying they don't want foreign troops, on the other, if they're going to have them, they have to stay or else they're afraid.
Yes, that is exactly the quandary here. And that is why coalition troops are confident that once they've proven their commitment, they will be well-received, they will be well-liked.
You've written about a job fair where the British military is looking for local people to help them staff up their operations at the port in Umm Qasr. Were they flooded with applicants? People must need the money.
Yes, they've had people banging down the door. Man, people coming from 40 miles away yesterday wanting to work at the port here. Their goal is to get people back to their old jobs. Another problem they've had is trying to parse out who really is qualified to do the jobs that they're opening applications for. So they've had, for example, six people show up and say they were the pilot who guided ships to enter the harbor when they know for a fact there was only one.
And what about the Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein's regime and its local representatives? Are they still walking the streets, making people afraid or not?
There are still Ba'ath Party members and militia at large in Umm Qasr. As recently as 2 days ago, the British commandos arrested 15 of them. Today, this afternoon, there was some sort of firefight or military action in town between Ba'athist elements and the British. You could hear the shelling, and tonight, as on every night in the last week, there have been nighttime raids in town where the British shoot flares over neighborhoods as they go from house to house looking for Ba'athists. They are still out there. And that's part of why people in the community are still afraid to speak. They're not going to feel at liberty to say anything critical of the regime openly and with their names attached to it. On the other hand, people have said to me, when we see that Saddam is dead, then we will feel safe. If the people here are convinced that his regime is gone for good, then they might be convinced that a new day has dawned for Iraq.
Thanasi Kambanis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanasi Kambanis is a correspondent with the Boston Globe newspaper. He spoke with us from Umm Qasr. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for this program comes from